Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On last week's show, during the beginning, when we asked our guests to highlight journalism that stands out, we got a suggestion for Chris Hamby's investigation about a private global super court that empowers corporations to bend countries to their will. So we decided to invite Chris on to tell us about his investigation. Chris Hamby is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with BuzzFeed, and he spent 18 months on these stories. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's great to have you, and congratulations on this story. Before we dive in and talk about it, since we learned about your story during the beginning of our show last week, we always ask our guests to highlight good journalism out there. I want to ask you the same thing. What really caught your eye this week?
A couple of things, actually, and I'll go through them real quickly, but they're both in the criminal justice realm. And so the folks over at the Marshall Project, which is a great nonprofit that focuses on criminal justice issues, have teamed up with The Guardian to do some great stories on the way that the public defender system is kind of in shambles throughout the country. And they really dug in Louisiana and found some very disturbing examples, including people like, you know, real estate and adoption attorneys, people who have no business representing criminal defendants, getting enlisted to defend them. And it sort of highlights the way that we've sort of eviscerated a lot of the Sixth Amendment rights that we thought we had.
Wow.
The other thing...
And Chris, before you move on, since you brought up the Marshall Project, I just wanted to let listeners know there's all of these new nonprofit organizations out there, and they do such good work, and they don't always get that much attention. So the Marshall Project is a nonpartisan nonprofit outlet that focuses specifically on criminal justice issues in the United States. It was founded by former New York Times executive editor Bill Keller, and they just do really good work on this issue.
They do. They do some great stuff. I like reading them a lot. Then the other thing I wanted to mention quickly is I got to give a shout out to my colleagues here at BuzzFeed News, Alex Campbell and Katie Baker, who did a great investigation on a really disturbing number of sexual assault cases being dismissed as unfounded by police across the country. And they, in this case, really dug in Baltimore County and have some really harrowing examples there of cases that were just dropped with very little to no investigation. And it's really, some of these stories will really enrage you, I think, if you read them.
Wow. And what happens to these women? And what are, do the cases get dropped?
Yes, and it's, if you read some of the responses that they've gotten from the police seeking to justify why they basically didn't investigate these cases, or in some instances actually sort of seem to blame the victim. They go into one case in particular where there seems to be a perpetrator who has a pattern of doing this and has been able to continue doing it because his cases have not been investigated adequately.
Wow. Well, related to that story, this morning NPR had an interview with Amanda Nyan, I think her last name is. She's an activist for the rights of sexual assault victims. She was also assaulted, and they did a good interview about a bill that was passed by the Senate and the House called the Survivors Bill of Rights. President Obama is expected to sign this, and it is going to dictate how the justice system should treat sexual assault victims and then also determine the kind of access they have to evidence collected through rape kits. So a lot of survivors say that this is a very important piece of legislation, and Obama is expected to sign it.
That's fascinating, and I think if you read the stories that the story that Alex and Katie did, you'll come away thinking that there's real need for reform in that area.
Well, thank you for that. We will put links to those articles at yourcallradio.org. And Chris, since you brought up your colleagues Alex and Katie, who did an investigation, you know, a lot of people might not know that BuzzFeed puts a lot of resources into investigative journalism. Can you tell us a bit about that before we talk about your story?
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to promote BuzzFeed. No, actually, it's been a terrific experience. I've been there for a little over two and a half years now, and I came over when we were sort of first starting our investigative team, and they have really put a lot of resources into this. We have probably one of the largest investigative teams in the country. We've got at least a dozen people domestically in Washington, New York, and in California, and then we've got a team in London as well. We've got one person in Australia. And they really, we take this very, very seriously, and they, I can't imagine a lot of places that would have given me 18 months and said, go to El Salvador, go to Egypt, go to Indonesia, and do the reporting you need to do to bring this big, ambitious project home.
Wow. Well, when you left the Center for Public Integrity, we've had you on before, when you were there, we thought, Chris is going to BuzzFeed. There must be a reason why. So this is clearly it. So let's talk about your piece. As you said, you spent 18 months looking into how corporations and banks around the world use this little-known system called investor-state dispute settlements. These are secret tribunals to basically help them subvert laws of sovereign nations. They help executives dodge punishment for their crimes. First off, how did you find out about this? Investor state dispute settlements, known as ISDS.
So I believe I was just reading an article about some sort of mining dispute, I believe in El Salvador, and there was a reference, I think, further down in one of these stories, as so often it leads to other good projects, is something that's sort of buried in a news item. And what it made reference sort of generally to this private legal system in which there was a sort of parallel case unfolding over this mining project, and I just sort of found that interesting more from a theoretical perspective of, I wasn't aware that this even existed, and I think most people aren't aware that this even existed, but it actually is, the more I started looking into it, reading about it, talking to people involved in the system, you come to learn that this is actually quite a large system that is enshrined in treaties really around the world, and that it has the number of cases is growing exponentially, and it has a significant impact on average people's lives, really, in a lot of countries in ways that we really don't see because we don't really have access to the functioning of the system for the most part.
And tell us more about ISDS. Where did it originate? Who came up with this idea?
So the idea generally dates back to the 1950s. There are sort of the intent behind this was to deal with, at that time you had a lot of newly independent colonies who there were, you know, the Western European nations, for example, were concerned that they were going to seize their factories and their mines that they set up there in the colonial era, and also, or just discriminate, you know, blatantly against foreign corporations in favor of domestic companies. And so they sort of set up this legal system of enforcement to in essence displace the need for, you know, gunboat diplomacy or, you know, diplomatic showdowns over these sorts of things, and just let investors bring claims directly against the government themselves. What has happened is that after it sort of laid dormant for a number of years, and it exploded in the 1990s after fall of the Soviet Union, and you have really sort of the Washington consensus sweeping the globe, so U.S. and World Bank policy, including treaties containing these provisions, and so you see a large number of these treaties, and then pretty soon you see a lot of disputes arising under these treaties, and they sort of take on a whole different light than they do than what was originally intended when the system was created decades earlier.
And they're written into NAFTA and the TPP, for example?
That's right. That's right. There are thousands of treaties between individual countries that are governing investment, but they're also in these very large, many of these very large trade deals like NAFTA, CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, TPP. Many of these, they're in there as well, and they're a key part. And NAFTA was really a key moment in this system, in sort of awakening. That was kind of the time in the when that was, entered into force in 1994, when you have a bunch of lawyers, mainly at large Western European and American firms, who look at this and say, "This is a very lucrative area of new practice potentially." And they get involved in this, and they start coming up with all these different ways to sort of stretch the interpretations of these really vaguely written treaties and bring all kinds of new kinds of cases.
So let's talk about how this translates out in the world. Based on your reporting from the Middle East, Central America, and Asia, you found so many examples. A Dubai real estate mogul and former business partner of Donald Trump was sentenced to prison for collaborating on a deal that would swindle the Egyptian people out of millions of dollars. But he turned to IDSD, investor-state dispute settlements, and got his prison sentence wiped away.
Yes. So this is something that I think a lot of people, even within the system, are not really familiar as something that happens. But the more and more I looked at this, I started saying, well, there are a lot of cases here that involve serious and in many instances credible allegations or even convictions, findings of serious misconduct by the people involved. And they're actually filing these claims, suing the government as sort of a counterpunch when, rather than sort of appeal their conviction or go to a human rights body if they really feel like the human rights have been violated, this is a sort of a more attractive option for them. And what happened in that case with the Dubai real estate moguls, this was immediately after the revolution where the world was sort of transfixed by what happened on Tahrir Square in 2011, and this was one of the first sort of anti-corruption convictions that arose out of that. So it's a very important prosecution for the Egyptian people. And then what happens is this mogul almost immediately files a claim. You start to get more and more of these claims against the Egyptian government as they are really struggling in the wake of the revolution. And the potential liability is so large, and it is having such, just merely having these claims against you is having a real drag on their sort of fledgling government and economy. And so they just decide that it's the right thing to do to start settling. And so they start settling with all these people. And when they settle with this person, what I found out from his lawyers was that they actually wiped away his criminal conviction and halted two other investigations that were that they'd been looking at other projects that he'd been involved in.
Chris Hamby is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with BuzzFeed. He spent 18 months on this investigation about a private global super court that empowers corporations to bend countries to their will and help executives escape punishment. So we're talking about this ISDS. Chances are you haven't heard about this. It's called Investor State Dispute Settlements, and they're secret tribunals to help corporations subvert laws of sovereign nations, and then, as I said, help executives dodge punishment for their crimes. And if you have any questions for Chris about this investigation and what he found, we'd love to hear from you. He'll be on with us for about another 10 minutes. Toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You have so many other examples, Chris. In El Salvador, a court found that a factory had poisoned a village, including dozens of children, with lead, failing for years to take government-ordered steps to prevent the toxic metal from seeping out. The factory's owner's lawyers used ISDS to help the company dodge a criminal conviction and the responsibility for cleaning up the area. You have another story about two financiers convicted of embezzling more than $300 million from an Indonesian bank. They used ISDS to fend off Interpol, shield their assets, and nullify their punishment. What really stood out for you? I mean, all of these examples are interesting, but did any one really stand out for you?
I think so. Of the two you mentioned, I mean, those are all really sort of shocking to me. You have a staggering amount of money with the Indonesian alleged embezzlement case, and that was actually large enough to where it led to a large and controversial bailout, a government bailout of the bank that has continued to have reverberations to this day, really. And then in terms of just being in El Salvador, I mean, I went to this village that I was describing in El Salvador, and spending time with families there. I mean, the day that I arrived in this village, the very first interview I did was with a mother who had just lost 6 days earlier her 16-year-old child. Had suddenly and inexplicably died, and she could come up with no other reason but the fact that tests had previously shown that he had very high levels of lead in his blood. You know, another home I went to was a family trying to afford the medical tests that they needed to figure out what was happening to their son, who also had high levels of lead in his blood, and they had just gotten test results and found out that his kidneys were failing, which is a classic symptom of lead poisoning. So this is just those things really strike you as a human as sort of the cause of this.
Who are these ISDS lawyers?
They're largely lawyers from large Western European and American firms. Mm. And the interesting part about the way this system works is that you don't have judges deciding the cases. You have private arbitrators. And these arbitrators are basically, a lot of times they're the same people who are, they may argue in one case, and then they may be an arbitrator in another case. It's the same sort of pool of people. They, you know, sometimes jokingly refer to themselves as the club. And so you have a fairly small number of people, many of whom have sort of a corporate law background, exercising significant influence on this system that operates largely unaccountable and unseen, but nonetheless has significant impacts on entire nations of taxpayers in ways that they don't always get to see.
How does the ISDS shield companies from laws here in the United States?
So this is an interesting point, and the last installment in the series addresses the potential for the U.S. to basically be bitten by our own creation. I mean, we didn't really create this, but we helped spread it and make it into what it is today. So we have not lost a case yet. We basically only had to worry about Canada. We don't have a lot of treaties with countries that are home to businesses that would even have the possibility of suing us. Canada's really about it. We've had a couple from Mexico as well. They've all been under NAFTA. What would happen if we conclude the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, and even more so if we conclude the other major trade deal that the Obama administration is pushing with the European Union nations, is that we would expose ourselves to a larger, much, much larger number of companies that could file claims against us. So we have had some scares, and actually I detail in the installment in this series, the very first case that we faced was this sort of, it's almost comical, but it's not, because there would have been severe consequences for the United States. But, I mean, this was an instance where you had this small spat over funeral homes in Mississippi, and it ends up going all the way to the highest levels of the White House with concern. You have the Justice Department saying that, you know, we're likely to lose this case on the merits, and, you know, this could undermine the American justice system more broadly. And we sort of get out of it by a last-minute stroke of luck, and I'll let readers see what that is by checking out that story. But, I mean, we are certainly not as invulnerable as the lead negotiators in the government currently would have people believe and have said that we are.
And you report that when Congress votes on whether to give final approval to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Public Citizen calls NAFTA on steroids, President Obama is a huge supporter of the TPP, it will be deciding on a massive expansion of ISDS. Can you explain why?
Right. Well, ISDS is an important provision in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and this will be arguably the largest expansion of the system ever.
Wow.
Bigger than NAFTA. It will cover a huge portion of the, you know, the economic activity in the world, and it really also has symbolic significance in that this is really a key moment for the system, because you're starting to see a backlash where countries are speaking out against it and trying to get themselves out of these treaties and out of some of these other agreements containing this. And you have even the European Union proposing significant reforms to this system. The U.S. is pretty steadfastly pressed forward, albeit with some reforms in TPP. But this is just sort of an important moment to decide for a lot of people. Are we going to continue with the system as is? Are we going to come up with some sort of reform system? Or are we going to do away with it entirely?
Mm. You've got a good graph in your story about how this really works. And you show that, you basically show a lawyer and a judge. You write that the same corporate lawyer who argues ISDS cases, in fact, a lawyer might argue a case one day and judge another the next day?
That's right. That's what I was trying to allude to earlier, is that this is sort of all these are the same people in a lot of cases. So it's amazing how much when you start to dig into the system, you see the same people popping up over and over again. And you really, it is a system that is largely dominated by the major Western European and American law firms. And yes, they sort of move in and out from position as counsel to position as arbitrator, and I think even they recognize that, you know, that does at least present the appearance of a problem, a potential conflict. Now, they say that, you know, there is nothing wrong with that, they're scrupulous and very fair, but it is, you know, they realize that at the least it poses a perception issue for the system as a whole.
Hmm. We have an email from Tim who says, this sounds like bad science fiction. In a future where all nation laws are superseded by corporate lawyers, thank you for getting this information out there. I get labeled as a paranoid when I talk about this stuff. Friends say you're exaggerating. And then he writes, I'm surprised Obama is pushing so hard for the TPP, which will make this worse.
Mm. So, and I also, thanks for your email. And I think it's important to point out that these tribunals don't have the authority to overrule a nation's courts, in the sense that they can't say, they cannot order a nation to change its laws. What they can do is impose or threaten to impose such massive penalties that a country does that themselves instead. Which is what we've seen, and this is a heightened danger because as we mentioned, there's countries really don't have a lot of faith in the structure and functioning of the system. There is no meaningful appeal to this. They are required by the treaties that they've signed to treat the judgments of these private arbitrators in many cases as having the same legal force as a decision of their own highest court. So in other words, this panel could issue a decision and it would be tantamount to a U.S. Supreme Court decision in some instances. And these penalties have been in the hundreds of millions or even billions in some cases, and it's a very unpredictable how these cases are going to come out, and we just really don't know much about it. So that's why it sort of heightens the risk for a country who's looking at, do I really want to risk a huge chunk of my budget fighting this? Is it worth it? Or am I just going to maybe compromise on my regulatory agenda here?
Well, thank you for that email, Tim. Let's go to a caller. Stuart Gross is calling in. Stuart is a lawyer who was quoted in your story, Chris, one of your stories about big mining companies in Indonesia. Hi, Stuart. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Chris, great articles. It came out amazing.
Thanks, Stuart, and thanks for calling in.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard you on my local station. I was like, I got to call in. I wanted to comment on something. And one is you just touched on, and it's a great point, which is the enforceability of these awards. So just a point that people may not be aware of, when you get a judgment in another country, it's usually very difficult to enforce that judgment elsewhere. That's not the case with these arbitration awards. There's two treaties, one called the Washington Treaty and one called the New York Treaty. They have some of the most wide adoption in the world, and they make, as Chris accurately put it, these judgments, these rulings by the arbitration panels, pretty much immediately enforceable with almost no review. So it's not just a matter of having a regime that adjudicates these cases. It's also that the result, once adjudicated, is very easy to enforce, including in countries like the United States and the countries of Europe, where a lot of these smaller countries like Indonesia have assets. The other point to make is there's a disturbing trend that you see of companies doing what's called the use of flags of convenience, where they set up a subsidiary in a country that has a treaty with the country in which they're doing business, and then they sue that country through that subsidiary. So even if you, for example, have a Chinese company who's doing business in the United States, and hypothetically that Chinese company could then set up a subsidiary in Mexico and then sue the United States through that subsidiary under NAFTA. So it's one of the mechanisms that corporations use, which make, to my mind, this system of interlocking bilateral and multilateral investment treaties such, frankly, a threat to representative and democratic systems of government.
Stuart, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. I think we need to do an entire show on this. Would you mind holding and giving your number to Laura Flynn, our producer, because we'd love to invite you back with Chris. Chris, this is really in some ways difficult to understand. As Stuart was explaining that, it's as someone who doesn't follow this very closely, I mean, you really need to spend a lot of time understanding exactly how this works.
That's right. And that's why I was very fortunate to have the time and resources to devote 18 months to this. And that's, why it took 18 months to do this and to go to Egypt and El Salvador and Indonesia and do this reporting.
We'd love to have you back. Before we let you go, what sort of response have you received from other media outlets and also governments around the world that you write about?
It's been encouraging. I've been very glad to see that the stories are reaching people. I've gotten emails and messages from Africa, from Asia, from staffers, staff members of the European Parliament, which is very engaged on this issue. And so it's been encouraging to hear that, and also from people in Indonesia. Sure, Stuart will be glad to hear that we're getting a lot of requests to translate the stories and promote them there. So I think it is something that people are reading, thinking about, and it's really encouraging.
Well, Chris, thank you for your reporting. We'd love to have you back for the entire hour to talk about this more in detail.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much. Chris Hamby is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with BuzzFeed. He spent 18 months on this investigation about a private global super court that empowers corporations to bend countries to their will and empowers corporations to help executives escape punishment. You can find Chris's series of articles at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, we will talk about media coverage of the ongoing action at the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota against the $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our media roundtable, and we are now going to talk about what's happening in North Dakota as Native American tribal members and others continue their stand against the $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline. The media are now paying attention. The pipeline would carry more than 400,000 barrels of crude oil every day from the Bakken region of western North Dakota across South Dakota and Iowa down to Illinois. The governor of North Dakota has put the National Guard on alert as protesters await a judge's decision on the pipeline. According to the LA Times, the National Guard is so far limited to serving as an imposing uniformed presence at what it called, quote, traffic information points, but it could be put to more active duty if needed. This news comes a week after Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman went to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota to interview Native Americans, and she found security guards with attack dogs and pepper spray. And joining us to talk about ongoing coverage is Mark Trahant, an independent journalist and professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota. He has been covering this. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Well, I wanted to play a clip from Democracy Now!, but it's better to be seen. There's a lot of screaming because dogs are biting horses and people, and then people are also being pepper sprayed. So I really encourage you, if you haven't already, to watch that video. Mark, your initial thoughts when you saw that video, what were you thinking?
I was horrified. Just the makeup of the water protectors ranges from women, children, unarmed. Everybody there is unarmed. In fact, the camp goes to great lengths to make that so. And to have those dogs, it was just incredibly vicious.
And Democracy Now! Has done a lot of extensive coverage about where the dogs came from, how is this legal, the backstory. A lot of people, because of social media, have been doing a lot of investigations around this. When something like this happens, you've got a major, major event. There's only one major media outlet there, gets this incredible footage. How do you think media outlets should respond at that point?
Well, there was media there. They just weren't at that particular site. The growth in the media has been really interesting because when it first started as a story, they kept folks said, come on, cover this. This is at least as important as what happened in Oregon.
Right.
And there wasn't a lot of response. By this last weekend, they now have a portion of the camp they call Media Hill, and there are some 40 outlets there. So that part of it is starting to get much more coverage. Lawrence O'Donnell, for example, was on site the same time as Amy Goodman. That said, the type of coverage is still, I think, not very deep. For example, your last segment of the show, I think, is an interesting parallel in that a piece I wrote yesterday for Yes Magazine was on how the Nixon administration handled its crisis and how they were using the power of the federal government, law enforcement, FBI, and troops. And indeed, now you have these private security forces that are outside of the scope of law. And it really opens up a lot of questions about what the role of the private sector is versus the role of government.
Hmm. So talk a little bit about how you think the media should tackle that issue, as opposed to just sort of following other coverage.
Yeah, I think so much of the coverage is focused on what's happening right now and not getting to the policy issue. And ultimately, this is a policy story. What's happening there is because of what's happened to two things. One, how we're going to transport oil in the era of climate change. And also, and more important, how important is water in our society now? And those two things need to have those threads kind of followed to where they ultimately lead.
Your piece in Yes Magazine, you point out that on July 25th, the Army Corps granted authorization for the pipeline to cross the Missouri River and Lake Oehe, and developers hoped to open the pipeline sometime later this year. And so today, any minute now, we are waiting for a U.S. District Court judge to issue a ruling on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's request for an injunction to stop the pipeline from being routed under the Missouri River. It's about a half a mile from the reservation. And on social media, I just heard from Ben Alex Dupree. He's an artist and filmmaker who was on the show recently, and he's there. And he said right now they're waiting. They expect the decision to come down any minute now.
Today's the day to wait, exactly.
And so can you tell us the significance of this ruling?
I don't know. The chairman of the tribe has been very clear about that no matter what the ruling is, this is going to continue. He said if we lose, there's going to be an appeal, and if the company loses, there's going to be appeal. So he's urging people to see this as a part of a broader, longer story that's going to play out. He's left the camp preparing essentially for winter.
Can you say that again, Mark? We lost you there.
Oh, they're preparing essentially for winter.
Oh, wow.
Be there for as long as it takes.
Mark Trahant is an independent journalist and professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota, and he has been writing about the standoff at the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota. This is now getting a lot of media attention. What are your thoughts on the coverage it's getting? Did you see the video last week? Democracy Now! Got video of security guards and attack dogs and pepper spray. The Morton County Sheriff's Office said four private security guards and two dogs were injured after several hundred protesters confronted construction crews. That really made it into the media on Monday. But then you had the Democracy Now! Video coverage showing that, in fact, protesters were attacked by dogs and sprayed with pepper spray. So what do you make of the coverage? 866-798-8255. What really stands out for you? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Mark, it was interesting to see how the sheriff... that the story coming from the sheriff's office versus the video that we saw from Democracy Now! And I was thinking, you know, what if Democracy Now! Hadn't been there? What would the story have been?
Well, exactly. And the sheriff and the state have actually promoted false narratives. They keep talking about this as if it's a group with violent outcomes, and they keep sending that signal that, in fact, one case they talked about a potential of pipe bombs when they were talking about pipes that are used for ceremonial purposes. And that narrative is stuck too often in the media. That's one of the problems. The thing is, when people visit the camp, it changes everything. And whether or not it's a politician or the media, once they're at that camp, they come away with a deep appreciation, one, how peaceful it is, and two, how serious a purpose it is.
Can you talk about how Native American media outlets are covering this? One of your pieces, The Test of an Indispensable Nation, is when Standing Rock is not left out or left behind. You wrote that for Indian Country Today.
Well, sort of. I have a weird thing where my blog, anybody can pick up that wants to.
Okay, so they picked up your blog.
Right.
Yeah.
They took it from that. But, yeah, the Indian media has been there in great numbers, and it's just fabulous to see. Producers, reporters, writers have said, you know what, this may be the most important story of our generation, and they've gotten a car, drove perhaps all night, and now are at the camp. And they're coming in, going out, and writing really great stuff. I mean, the diversity of stories coming from the Native press is really inspiring.
Where do you go for Native coverage other than Indian Country Today?
There's a group called Native News Online that's there now. A really great piece. Montana journalism students went, and they were all Native. They did a piece for Montana Journalism Review. The Native America Calling has sent people from public radio, and then local tribal outlets.
And just to provide a few more details, the tribe says that 18 million people will be affected by this pipeline. You know, the other piece that's missing from this, Mark, is what's going on in Iowa, because the pipeline would go through Iowa, and a number of mostly older women have been protesting that piece of it. And last I read on their Facebook page, a few of them are camping out.
Right. Yeah, well, and the argument has been up until Keystone XL that pipelines are safer than rail or transporting by truck. And what this latest argument had come up is saying, wait a minute, if we're ever going to start to turn on climate change, we are going to need to start reducing the flow. And that's going to be baby steps. It's going to mean changing the way we do things. And that means stopping what the UN calls unnecessary infrastructure. And this is exactly that. It's a big piece of infrastructure that, if you read the publications from the oil companies, is all about design to increase the flow, not to slightly reduce it.
There has been good coverage in the New York Times, for example, about past spills and how these spills have just devastated communities. There was a good piece in 2013 called Amid Pipeline Debate, Two Costly Cleanups Forever Change Towns.
Right. And the folks at Cannonball are saying that's what we don't want to be a community where they have to truck in bottled water because our water is ruined.
Wow.
That's exactly the point.
And this piece was specifically about the Kalamazoo River and Talmadge Creek, the largest oil pipeline failure in the country's history. And then Exxon Mobil pipeline burst in Mayflower, Arkansas, releasing thousands of gallons of oil and the evacuation of 22 homes. This happened back in 2013. And Mark, what about the angle of what's happening in the camp itself? Because when Ben Alex Dupree called in last week, he said that, you know, people are leaving their jobs. So many tribes from across the country are going to Cannonball, North Dakota, to express solidarity with the Sioux tribe.
Right. And there are really three main camps, and so people are moving to one of the three, and it continues to grow by the day. One of the stories that I think is just remarkable is there's this young woman named Tink who is in charge of the logistics of food and is the chief cook. And imagine being at a campsite without much of modern amenities, and all of a sudden you're trying to manage donations of buffalo, bushels of corn, all these kinds of food products, and then trying to organize a menu out of it every single day and handling the logistics. And she's just done an amazing job in a very short period of time.
And some of these media outlets that do great jobs with video, like Fusion, AJ Plus, they've really focused on her story. Can you talk about the role that social media is playing in really getting this story out?
Oh, social media owned this story. When the networks and other mainstream media weren't interested at all, it was trending number one on either Twitter or Facebook. And it was this instant communication between people across, particularly Indian Country, but also the environmental movement, where people saw the story, shared it, passed it on, and then got in a car and went there.
And, Mark, you also wrote about this. This was an amazing moment when President Obama was in Laos. He was conducting a town hall with young people, and a young Malaysian woman stood up and expressed solidarity with the indigenous people who are fighting to protect their land and their water from this pipeline. She clearly caught President Obama off guard, because he's usually really good in these sessions, and he really stumbled and basically said the Native Americans haven't been treated well, but I'm going to have to ask my staff about that.
Extraordinary moment, and it was clearly a failure of his staff, probably senior staff, because I know that folks who work on Native issues know the issue really well and probably passed it on in memos, but somehow it did not get to the president, and clearly that was an awkward moment for him. The hope is, particularly out of the camps, is that he goes back and says, all right, what's going on, and takes an interest, because he's been there. He's visited with those families. He knows what's at stake.
Right. He was there last year.
Correct.
Yeah, I don't think he expected a Malaysian woman in Laos to ask about the Dakota Access Pipeline.
No, not at all.
And I think that just speaks to the power of social media, because I'm guessing, I'd love to interview her. I bet she learned about it through social media.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Obama hasn't said anything, and Hillary Clinton hasn't said anything.
Right,
and
right.
Donald Trump hasn't said anything.
Oh, no, but Donald Trump's key advisor is somebody who's worked on those oil company, basically with the North Dakota oil producers.
His advisor worked with the company?
Yes.
Is that getting much attention?
It did in North Dakota last year when Donald Trump was here, particularly with the tribes, saying we need to do things differently, and this is going to be more of the same.
So, Mark, what's your next piece? What are you looking out for now, other than, well, the judge's decision is going to be huge, because he's either going to approve it or put a halt to it?
Right. But either way, that's going to keep going, because both sides will keep pushing this case until it goes probably all the way to the Supreme Court. And I think it's important to note that one of the real disconnects is that the state sees protest as basically holding a sign and staying out of the way, where folks on the ground are ready to use civil disobedience and see that as a legitimate strategy, where it's more about holding the line than holding a sign. And the state clearly doesn't understand that, and it has no they're not prepared for that. The piece I want to write next is really about water. And if you look at all of the science on climate change, it says water is going to become more precious. So how do we as a public policy start making water more precious? Hmm. And what investment do we do to make sure we're protecting key water sources?
You know, another angle is investment, and we just got this article from a listener, and we've been reading this by Will Bunch. It's called "Your Pennsylvania Tax Dollars at Work, Sicking Dogs on Native American Protesters." And Will Bunch writes about what happened last weekend, and then he also follows the money, basically. And a few more outlets are doing this to find out who's investing in this pipeline. He writes that a big chunk of the money out of Pennsylvania is financing these. It turns out one of the major investors of Energy Transfer's partner is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Wow. Fascinating. And one of the strategies for Energy Transfer's has been to do this project really quick and to not have the same review that basically took down both the Keystone XL and the Sandpiper projects. And clearly, that's too late. So it's going to get reviewed from now on, no matter what happens in today's court action.
And Mark, before we let you go, we have just a couple minutes left. So much of national media attention about Native Americans is often negative. It's about casinos, alcohol, suicides, poverty. I mean, those are obviously very important issues that deserve far more attention. But the few times that you do read about Native Americans in the national media, it tends to be pretty negative. This is really changing that.
It is. And one, again, social media played a role, but the leaders of these camps have been so methodical and careful in how they address the issues. And that, again, when people visit the camps, they come away inspired. They really see this as people doing it right and say, wow, why can't we do this way all the time?
It also is connecting the dots between indigenous people, the fight for the planet, healthy water, the land. A lot of people are learning about treaties. I mean, I've been reading comments on social media, and people are just really learning about the history of Native Americans and then just how they still are dealing with treaties and promises exactly. that have not been met.
Oh, and the idea that this is a best hope going forward, that this is a whole mechanism that could help us get to a more healthy outcome.
Are you planning to go to North Dakota anytime soon?
Well, I was there a week ago. I'm in North Dakota right now, but not at the camp. And I'm probably going back. I'm going to take students with me.
Oh, students from your class.
Right.
Just quickly, how are you teaching this in your journalism class? There's so much to focus on.
Oh, we spent a whole session on it last time. I'm just trying to get people to look at the big breadth of the story from both a historical narrative and one involving the science and one involving these really remarkable people.
Well, Mark Trahant, thank you again for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
Mark Trahant is an independent journalist and professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota, and you can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. Make sure, if you have not seen that Democracy Now! Video of the attack dogs and the pepper spray, be sure to watch that. Again, I wanted to play it, but there's so much screaming. It's much better if you can see it. And then in the coming hours, we're definitely going to get a decision from a U.S. District Court judge who will be ruling on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's request for an injunction to stop the $3.8 billion oil pipeline. And we will continue to follow this. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about marine sanctuaries. Last month, President Obama created the largest marine protected area on the planet. He expanded a national marine monument to include 500,000 square miles of waters in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. The designation bans commercial fishing and new mining. So what are the impacts of marine sanctuaries? Tweet your questions to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.